Blog Talk Radio.
Radio show. I'm Joanne Barton. Have a great show for you guys tonight. I may be flying solo, so if it seems like I don't know what I'm doing, I don't, in regard to the phones and all that stuff, but the techie stuff. But anyway, we'll be fine. John is trying to get in, John Arricchio. We are having a storm over here on the East Coast, specifically Jersey, Pennsylvania, Connecticut, the tri-state. So if we get knocked off, that's what happens. So anyway, we have a great show tonight. I'm really excited about it. We have author Stanley Goldman on, and he has a book out. It's called Left to the Mercy of a Rude Stream, The Bargain That Broke Adolf Hitler and Saved My Mother. I mean, the excerpts that I've read, I haven't read the book itself, but I want it. I mean, oh my God, this story is just amazing. You would not believe the experiences. I mean, wait till we talk about it. It's going to be great. And of course, we're welcoming back Mr. Anson Williams from Happy Days. He was supposed to be on in June. We rescheduled him for tonight, and he is going to grace us with his presence. Thank you, Anson. We appreciate it so very much. So before we get started, let's say thank you to our sponsors, The Hive Bar and Bistro in Garfield, New Jersey. They are doing pickup and delivery and also limited seating due to COVID. However, get on down there. The food is delicious. Precious Memory Video in Kitnersville, Pennsylvania. KWV Wines in South Africa. Tees for the Times and Other Stuff in Clifton, New Jersey. Syntech Productions in Lenoka Harbor, New Jersey. And Oleander Public Relations in Texas. And Take a Break from Cancer.org for Pete's sake. And Joey Max Hot Dog Truck and Cafe in Harrison, New Jersey, who are also doing pickup and delivery and seating, limited seating due to, I shouldn't say limited. I guess what's warranted due to the COVID and within safe guidelines. So, you know, within your 6 feet distance, I'm sure they're doing that. So anyway, check them out, check their websites, and if not, check our website and go to their link. So, like I said, we have two great guests on. So I'm going to give Stanley a call. And while I do that, I'm going to play the song that we aired, Wednesday? On Sunday's show, when we had Rosalind Kind on. Her new song, Light of Love, is beautiful. So I'm going to play a little bit of that for you while I get in touch with Stanley. Hang on 1 second, folks, while I give Stanley a call.
Thank you.
Hi, so sorry. Of course, we cut it off right when she started singing. Don't worry, we're going to play a little more when we get in touch with Anson. So I do have with me on the phone Mr. Stanley Goldman. He is the he's an author and professor, and, I mean, he's done some amazing things in crime, and just I can't wait to talk to him about it. And we are going to discuss his new book, which is, now it is a mouthful, but it deserves to be a mouthful. What's in here is just overwhelming. So Lecture the Mercy of a Rude Stream, The Bargain That Broke Adolf Hitler and Saved My Mother. Stanley Goldman, how are you, sir? Welcome to the show. We appreciate you coming on.
Why, I'm fine, and thank you so much for having me.
Oh, thank you. I mean, the title, I'm sitting here, I'm trying to figure it out. So, Left to the Mercy of a Rude Stream. So, now, should I take that as mom was left abandoned at a horrible stream, or has nothing to do with it at all?
No, that has to do with it. It's actually a paraphrasing of a line from Shakespeare's, believed to be his last play, Henry VIII, that the Rude Stream is the currents of history. And my mother, who survived the Holocaust, you know, was a bit of flotsam and jetsam, you know, just as a regular, ordinary person was thrust into the middle of this nightmare. And no matter what the Germans threw at her during the war, there was, you know, she seemed, in spite of that, get through it. And so she was left to that mercy of that rude stream of that, those currents of history, and yet made it through.
Thank God. Now, is mom still alive? She's still alive?
No. She passed away 20 years ago.
Oh, wow. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, it wasn't until years after she died that I happened to just, or at least someone I knew happened to stumble across something and showed it to me and asked me if this had anything to do with my mother. I looked at it and did some research and discovered that it actually was sort of almost the end story of how my mother, you know, escaped a death camp. And it took me a number of more years to research it till finally I decided at the urging of some friends to put it into a book, which took me another several years.
Wow. Well, you are known for your investigative work. I mean, you've worked on some amazing cases. You've done the Scott Peterson case, OJ, Michael Jackson, Timothy McVeigh. So, I mean, you really know your stuff when it comes to investigating, and you also are a professor in that as well, right, at Loyola?
I was a tenured professor at the law school, and then I took a leave of absence for about a dozen years of sorts to go into the news business. Before I was a professor, I spent 8 years as a public defender trying cases in downtown Los Angeles, then became a law professor, then took about a dozen years off to be a reporter. I worked for, I had my own show for a little while. I anchored on CNBC on Saturday night. I wrote for 2.5 years for the New York Daily News. I had a weekly column for them for 2.5 years. I then was contacted by Roger Ailes a few months before the Fox News Channel was due to come on the air, and he asked me if I'd be interested in becoming the network's first legal correspondent and legal analyst. And I did that for a number of years, which leads to a line at the beginning of my book when I'm trying to describe something about myself, that I'm the only person who will probably ever live who qualifies for a pension with the L.A. County Public Defender and the Fox News Channel. So I did that for a decade and with the Fox News Channel, and Roger Ailes and I finally, shall we say, parted ways, and I went back to being a full-time tenured law professor.
Mm. Now, this is like an oxymoron question for you. What made you decide to write this book, and which was the stupid question? The other one is, why did you wait so long to write it?
I had no idea. You know, I'd always been trying to figure out how my mother survived. She was in three different concentration camps, two of them death camps. She had a time during the war that was, if you didn't you know that it was true, you'd think it was made up. She literally was in line to the gas chamber at Auschwitz, literally standing in line, and was along with another group of women she had arrived in the camp with, about to be executed. Literally, I have the testimonials of a couple of other women who were there right with her, as well as my mother, and the last possible moment, almost as if it was a movie screenplay, you know, intended to draw out the nightmare, just as she was about to get in the chamber and be killed, she was they took her and the group of women she was with, and they gave them some clothes, and they put them on a train, and they're riding for 3 days and three nights on this very slow-moving train. They can barely breathe, and there's no food and water, and all of a sudden the train stops, and the doors open, and they're in Berlin, you know, because workers apparently were needed in a factory in Berlin, and so they shipped these Jewish women out of Auschwitz the last possible second to go there. And then she, you know, gets sent to, after, you know, she survives the Allied bombing raids of Berlin at the height of the bombings, and then, you know, gets sent to another death camp, and then gets somehow miraculously rescued out of that death camp. And I never quite understood how any of this happened, and I kept researching it when I was young and could never find anything. And it was literally till, you know, 7 years after she passed away, when, as I said, I stumbled across something that seemed to be a link, and I managed to pull that thread, and it led me to other information, and then more information, and then sort of put me on the right direction, and then I ended up writing a short article on it, and a Holocaust scholar contacted me after I published this short article of a few pages sort of summarizing it, and said, you know, you really should turn this into a book. And I said, you know, a book, what do I need with a book? And then about 2 years later, I found myself with, I had a paid semester unexpectedly. I was given an extra sabbatical to do work if I wanted it. And I said, well, yeah, maybe instead of writing about law, I'll start researching this book more expansively. So I researched for another 4 years, it turned out, and every minute of my spare time, and then put together enough information that I then spent another 4 years organizing into a book. I suppose that's it. I just didn't have the and I don't think I could have written the book in the 20th century. I think the amount of research done that I did really depended in large part on many other books being written, and so that I could do the research, and those almost didn't exist in the 20th century. Some of them did, but a number of them were published now in the last 20 years that allowed me to put the thing together. And by the way, I didn't write it like a law professor. I mean, I used to write for the New York Daily News, which, as you know, is the country's oldest and best tabloid in many ways. And the style I wrote, you know, for the New York Daily News is the style I wrote this book in. So it's not, it's not only you don't have to be a lawyer to read it. I basically tried to write it at about a high school senior level, in my opinion, in terms of the information I was conveying, so it could be understood by all sorts of people, even if English wasn't their first language. I have some people who are Italian lawyers who contacted me and said, you know, I could, you know, that they understood the book very clearly in spite of, you know, English being their second language. And,
how old was Mom when this was all going on?
My mother was about 35. 34, I think, actually, 34 or 35 when she was rescued. So she was not she was actually one of the oldest women in her group. And it turns out in the nightmare that was the Holocaust, it tended to be the very young ones who survived, because they were usually the ones, you know, strong enough to have made it through all the work for all those years.
Right.
And my mother was one of the older women, but as a result, she was, you know, somebody that, you know, kind of, if not led the other women, had some influence over them because she was older. You know, there's one woman whose life she saved, you know, told me the story after my mother passed away, how they were in Berlin, and the bombs were raining down on the factory they were working in, and they ran. It was at night, and they ran hoping that they would be able to get into a bomb shelter. Sometimes at night they'd let the Jews in. If not, they would just make them stay outside while the German workers got into the bomb shelter. But at night there weren't as many workers, and this was a bombing raid at night, and they're running, and the woman who told me the story said that she basically had given up, you know, and she's sitting there on the ground and says, I'm not going to go any further. I can't do this anymore. I just want to let them kill me. And my mother just grabbed her, you know, around her shoulder, lifted her up. And my mother, by the way, was like 4'10", and even at her heaviest was maybe 90 pounds. So lifted this woman up and said, you're not going to die. You're going to live. You're not going to let these Nazis win. And dragged her towards the bomb shelter. And when they got to the front door of the bomb shelter, which they were about to be let in, a bomb hit right exactly where this woman had been, you know, had decided to lay down and not move anymore. So she would have been killed, you know, and if my mother had stayed with her, she would have been killed. But they made it to the bomb shelter. So part of that was because these women were younger than my mother, and my mother was sort of a senior citizen in comparison to the rest.
Wow. Well, you mentioned Heinrich Himmler. How was he responsible for saving your mother at one point? I only had a brief overview of the book. I have not read it. I don't have a copy. But the excerpts I have read, I'm just taken aback. I can't even tell you. But, I mean, writing this, I wanted to ask you about Heinrich Himmler. But how did this not kill you? Writing this, knowing what your mother went through,
I tried to treat the history of it sort of a little bit detached, in the sense that, you know, I'm a college professor for years, so for large swaths of the book, I tried to put it together as if it wasn't about my mother and about my own, you know, life.
Right.
But there was a point at which they're all, you know, I just had to sit down and work on parts clearly about my mother. And people had for years assumed that I dyed my hair. That may seem like a very strange, you know, curve, right, that I'm throwing. But the answer was I actually never dyed my hair. I was lucky through heredity on my mother's side of the family, apparently, not to have any gray hair. I sat down and started writing the section about my mother, which ended up taking me 6 months. I got gray around the temples. Right. I got a lot of gray hair suddenly, came in those 6 months. I finished those 6 months working on my mother's section, and I put the pen down, and I didn't get any more gray hairs after that.
Wow.
I mean, so that, yes, it did age me. It was extremely difficult sometimes to write about her, particularly when I couldn't sort of put a distance between me and her.
Right. I mean, because you needed that heart to write it too, but yet you needed to separate yourself to some extent so you could write it. You know what I mean? And then how if this was about my mother, oh my God, I'd be in Germany knocking everybody over right now. But you know,
and I do write a little about that in the postscript about how some of what kept me going through what was a lot of tough nights, unable to sleep because of thinking about it. What got me through it was, in some respects, anger. I mean, I don't think it comes through in the writing of the book, but that was a driving force. About Himmler, by the way, this is truly arguably the most bizarre, although not the finale of the book, but perhaps the most bizarre thing about the book in terms of the actual story. Himmler, by early 1945, realizing that the war at the beginning of 45, realizing that the war was not going well, Himmler, like so many other Nazis, had, you know, self-survival was far more important than anything else. So he actually sent out some assistants, some underlings, to live in and work in neutral countries. The primary one being an assistant, if you want to call it that, a kind of father confessor of his, an advisor, who he sent to Stockholm.
Yeah.
And the goal was for this fellow in Stockholm who worked for Himmler to try to get connections with the West, hoping for a pipeline literally to Eisenhower or Churchill or Roosevelt or something, because what Himmler was perfectly prepared to do, being the second most powerful man in Germany, second only to Hitler, he wanted to try to form a separate peace with himself and the West, literally offering the surrendering, which is something he actually had some considerable control over, the entire Western Front. I mean, what he feared most was being captured by the Russians and being tortured and executed. So he sent this assistant to Stockholm, and the assistant, nobody was willing. I'm sorry?
Stan, I'm sorry. Nothing but a bunch of cowards.
They were, yes, absolutely.
I didn't mean to interrupt, but when you said that he was afraid of what was going to happen to him, you piece of shit. Anyway.
He was. It was purely, you know, even in the end of the war, even if you were a German, you should have realized this, because Himmler, on the one side, was trying to surrender to the West, realizing the war was over, but sent out messages and gave speeches to the SS troops that were under his control, saying, "You will fight to the last man. You know, anybody who does not do their job by fighting will be executed." Mm-hmm. You know, and so he was going to use the power of his position to place him even in a better position by having these troops fight to the death so that he could cut a deal for himself. So the guy in Stockholm was working for Himmler. He really can't seem to get a connection. And then one day, of it all things, at a tea party on a Sunday afternoon, he is introduced of all people, this German during the middle of the war, to a Jewish guy, an industrialist who's very rich, has fled himself from Latvia at the beginning of the war with his family and is now living in Stockholm. They didn't let too many Jews in, by the way, before and during the war, the Swedes, very few. But this guy was so rich, he had connections and managed to be one of the couple of thousand Jews that that were let in. And the industrialist was something apparently of a huge personality, capable of bargaining and bluffing, and he convinces this Nazi attaché that he can do almost anything, including getting connection to the West and giving this underling Nazi perhaps free passage, if the war ends badly for the Germans, to South America and a passport to go to South America. So he spins this long yarn, and in exchange for which he wants to meet with Himmler and discuss the freeing of Jews. And this Nazi underling of Himmler's is so mesmerized by this guy that he actually contacts Himmler and persuades him to meet with this Jew. And Himmler agrees at the urging of his underling, but only on condition that they meet near Berlin at a secret, at a home discreetly, so that nobody else will know about it.
Right.
Well, they literally, so this thing is arranged. The Jewish industrialist is about to leave when they're at the airport. There's a Nazi plane on the tarmac. It's got a swastika on the side. He's going to fly out with just this underling of Himmler as the only other passenger on it. But this industrialist wife, who has been against this the whole time, tells him at the airport that she will kill herself if he goes. Not that if he doesn't come back, but if he goes, she will kill herself, and he believes her. And he turns to some of the other Jewish businessmen from the community who've come with him to the airport just to see him off, and he turns to one of them who was born in Germany but as a teenager had moved to Sweden with his family. He turns to him and says, "You speak German fluently. It has to be you, because I can't go." And this other guy, who's 44, also a well-to-do businessman, he's a furrier of all things, just instead of going, What? You want me to go into the middle of Berlin in the middle of this war? A Jew? You want me to get on that plane right there, right now? And instead of going, "What are you, crazy?" he goes, "Oh, okay." And he gets on the plane, and he arrives, after they switch planes at one point, he arrives in at Berlin Airport, Tempelhof Airport, He gets off the plane, and he's immediately greeted by six SS officers in full dress regalia, and they all, as he walks towards them, you know, they spring their right hands in the air and shout, "Heil Hitler," to this little Jewish guy, who, according to an independent witness, then the Jewish business guy just takes his cap off, looks at them, and says, "Good evening." And then he gets driven in with the lights out because they're being bombed. So they drive for like 90 minutes down the secured route to get them to the home that he's supposed to meet Himmler at. And you know, I won't go into the detail. It was hazardous and death-defying, and eventually he has a meeting with Himmler, and he manages to do what the other industrialists did, which is to bluff. It's not just a bluff, it's like the bluff of the century. He convinces Himmler that he's got the power to arrange a ceasefire on the Western Front with the Allies if Himmler will just do a little something for him. And, you know, Himmler wants to know what he can do. And the primary thing he asks for, he says, "You know, as I was driving down here in the dark at night, I passed this camp at Ravensbrück. And we know that that's a Jewish camp, by the way. I mean, Jews were in this camp, I should say. But it was a women's camp. So there's a bunch of Jewish women sitting in this camp still being executed in gas chambers." And the Jewish businessman says, "I want you to order the immediate release of a bunch of those women as an example of your good faith here in exchange for my delivering this message." And Himmler goes, "Yeah, okay." And so he orders 1,000 Jewish women in the camp to be picked up and delivered, you know, to Sweden. Basically, they're going to be taken to the Baltic and then put on boats and sent to Sweden. That's just part of this story. You know, there were actually consequences for Himmler for cutting this deal because no one was supposed to know about it. It didn't stay secret for very long. And there were considerable negative consequences to Himmler when Hitler discovered that he was trying to cut such a deal. And that's, in many ways, what the book is about. That's
right. Now, I don't know if you can talk about these points, but how did the freeing of your mother lead to Hitler's suicide?
Well, without going into too much detail, which is sort of the almost the ultimate part of the book, Himmler was Hitler's closest and most trusted advisor. And as part of the research on the book, I was able to find some memoirs written by people who visited Germans, Nazis, who visited Hitler in the bunker in those last weeks of the war. And there were a couple of people who eventually wrote about it in their memoirs, a little red, but in their memoirs, who described the moment that they were with Hitler, and Hitler was informed by Goebbels, the head of his propaganda unit, that Himmler had apparently tried to work out this deal to create a separate peace on the Western Front in exchange for doing the greatest sin of all, other than betraying Hitler, was that he released a bunch of Jews from the camps, also a great sin. And when I've got one woman who was the mistress of an admiral who was in the bunker at the time, who described in her memoir of having been in the bunker, described how at that moment when Hitler received word of Himmler's betrayal, as far as Hitler was concerned, and his actions, she said, first he turned red, and then he turned white like he was dead, and he screamed, even the faithful Himmler. And the next day, Hitler wrote his what he called his political testament, which we survived to this day because he sent it out once he'd finished it with four different couriers in different directions, so one of them would make it out of Berlin, blaming Himmler's betrayal for his you know, for the losing of the war, the fact that the war is being lost. And then when he was done with that and they were sent out, Hitler put a bullet in his own head.
Wow. Amazing. Just amazing. I don't like to talk about politics, but you have investigated Nazism, white supremacists, I mean, everything. And you believe that we are, like all these anti-Semitic groups right now, do you believe that we could be on a course to possibly going back in time?
Look, the one thing I learned working on this book I seriously worked on it for 8 years. I actually worked on it longer. Yeah. And spending a lot of time thinking and reading about this was real hatred, race hatred, bigotries between groups. If they're strong enough, they never disappear. Even if they don't make the papers, they're passed down from from parents at dining room tables to their kids.
Right.
And there's always the potential of new recruits.
Right.
And although it doesn't always result in mass atrocities like the Holocaust, genocides do always begin the same way. They begin with a hatred in which the opposition is dehumanized. You know, they're referred to as insects or animals or something less than human. And it turns out, When you read the psychiatry of this, that what psychiatrists and psychologists have been saying only in the last few years, is that studies have shown that there is a very small step, unfortunately, between hatred of others and a willingness to do them terrible harm in order to get rid of them. And, you know, there was a fellow who, ironically, famous philosopher and writer named Voltaire, obviously in 18th century France. And Voltaire was himself quite the anti-Semite, by the way. So it is ironic that, although I don't include it in the book, perhaps I should have, there is a line from Voltaire that I think is completely borne out by 21st century science, and that is, those who can make you believe absurdities can make you commit atrocities.
Well, you answered my question in regards to, you think it's happening today?
Yes, I think it is a real disadvantage, and that we are sometimes afraid to draw the analogies of what happened in Europe in the late 20s and in the 30s that gave rise to the totalitarian, authoritarian extremism of hatreds. That resolved itself into the final solution. I think we do ourselves a potentially terrible disservice by not willing to speak about that for fear that it's just too extreme, because it always begins with something much smaller. It always begins with some initial hatred and then grows.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you, one more question. What causes people to hate so much? I mean, with your background, do you know the answer? Can you give some?
I think it is genetic, and it is something we must always be vigilant about. You know, when humans lived in small communities in villages or caves, you are always fearful of the outsider because they might do you harm. The only people you could depend on are the ones you had gotten around yourself, your family, the close neighbors who you had this, you know, symbiotic relationship with. And when someone other would show up, that was a danger. And I think we genetically, Darwinianly kind of evolved like that, that the ones who were most fearful of the strangers who could sometimes provide danger and were trying to get what you had or even kill you, that those whose ancestors felt that way may have survived more and therefore passed that trait on. So it turns out that even infants, even if you're dealing with toddlers, when you can give tests like this, it shows that if they identify themselves with a particular group, then they view those members of the group much differently than they view others.
Right.
And it turns out there's a very small step between viewing someone as an other and different to hating them. And it turns out there's a horribly close connection between hating a group and being willing to commit terrible crimes against them in the belief that you're really defending yourself and your own kind.
Right. It's crazy. It's absolutely crazy. Well, Stanley, I wish we had more time because, I mean, I wanted to touch on the book so much more, but then again, we don't want to tell everybody the book. We want them to read it.
Right. I mean, if anybody is interested, you know, the best way to look it up, I realize the title's a little complicated, but I think just look up my name, Stan Goldman, which is hopefully not that hard to remember, on Amazon or at a local bookstore. And at the moment, Amazon, just by some coincidence today, put the book on a discounted sale. So it's at the moment, at least, literally, I'm not making that up, just starting today, it's marked down from $28 to $17.25 on Amazon. And it's a hardback, and, you know, it's published by a very reputable publisher. There's also recorded books, bought the audio rights. I did the audio myself. I had to audition, by the way, to be allowed to do it. They had an actor in mind for it. And I said, unless his name is Liev Schreiber, I'd like to do it myself. And his name wasn't Liev Schreiber, so they let me do it myself. So.
Well, who can tell it better than you? I mean, come on, you wrote it. So, I was just going to say, where can folks get the book, what you just told them? I got to ask you personally on my level, how many pages is it?
I will say to you, a professor, a famous scholar, wrote me about 6 months ago and said, your book contains more information in less words than any other book I have ever read. And I will tell you, part of those 4 years I spent writing it was trying to treat it like I wrote my New York Daily News columns, which was as tight as possible. It is, if you exclude the endnotes, which are 42 pages of endnotes, the book is exactly 150 pages long, and it is a very quick read. I spent years. An interviewer once said, after reading your book, I'm convinced you're a very wise person, this interviewer said to me, and I said, and my response was, it's easy to sound wise by the 35th draft, which is about the number of times I rewrote the book to get it to
right.
flow smoothly.
Yeah, I don't know how you fit all that into 150 pages. I'm thinking it's like a 400-page book, which would be overwhelming for me. And, you know, does it have pictures?
it does have a few pictures
of
my mother and me in the middle, but I don't think those get counted in 150 pages.
No. Well, Stanley, thank you so much for joining us. I will
sure.
let everybody know on our social where they can get the book and if they want to listen back to the interview.
Thanks. You know, and I will say this, the book is not depressing. It is intended, although it takes place during arguably the worst thing that ever happened to humanity. It is a book about the survival of a group of women and their strength to make it all the way through the war. There's even oddly humor in it. I don't think a book about Jews could not have some humor in it somewhere. I've got to tell you, it is in these times when we are stuck at home and all of us have so many problems, I actually think one line that my mother spoke to me when I was quite young and going through a tough time, one line maybe is emblematic of what the book is about, and her line to me was, Stanley, she had a very thick Yiddish accent, Stanley, it's better than being in Auschwitz. You know, and the reality is, when you read about how difficult people had certain parts of their life and yet lived through it and survived it and came out the other side, in a sense stronger for it, I think it's something to be considered in our time.
Excellent. Well, thank you again so much. Stanley Goldman, author of Left to the Mercy of a Rouge Dream, The Bargain That Broke Adolf Hitler and Saved My Mother, available on Amazon. Check it out. They just lowered the price today, and I can't wait to get it. I'll probably do the audio thing. I'm blind, so I can't see very well anymore. But thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
I thank you so much for letting me talk about it. I appreciate it.
Thank you, and all the best to you, Stanley. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. All right. Oh, my God. I mean, this book sounds amazing. I mean, if you're into, specifically, if you're into the Holocaust and how horrible it was and you want to know more information, this book is just the book.
I did have one real reviewer. I'm not talking about people who just write reviews on Amazon, but, you know, I one of the real reviewers actually said, if you only have time to read one book about the Holocaust, make it this one.
Definitely sounds like it to me, that's for sure. Well, thank you so much, Dan.
Sure, no, thank you.
Yeah, we're going to get Anson Williams on the line, and we're going to have fun with him, and we had a great time with Stanley. Thank you, sir. You have a good night, and take care.
Thank you.
Right. All right, bye-bye. All right, folks, like I said, yeah, check it out at Amazon, and if you can't find it under the name because it's a long name, but just go under Stan Goldman, and you'll find it. And so let's get Anson Williams on the phone. I can't wait to speak to him. Let me just make sure that I'm hanging up the right line here. Yep, I did. Can you believe it, folks? I pulled it off. All right, Johnny boy, you'd be proud of me. Anyway, I'm going to call Anson, and while I do, I'm going to play the Outsiders' new song, so enjoy. We'll talk to you in a minute. All righty then, let me give Anson a call, folks. Talk to you soon. All right, folks, we have on the phone with us Mr. Anson Williams from most notably known as Happy Days, but Anson has done so many amazing things, and I thank you so much for coming back, Anson. I know we were scheduled for June, and I thank you so much for coming back. Ladies and gentlemen, Anson Williams on the show with us, the Plus Radio Show. How are you, sir?
I'm good. How are you? Please, it's Anson.
I
feel too old with the word sir.
I'm sorry, but you're a legend to me. I can't help it. I can't help myself, you know? But I just want to say thank you. I mean, this is a thrill for me. When we had Don on the show as well, I had to brag about the fact that every Tuesday night we sat around. It was one of my mother's favorite shows and became ours as well. But, I mean, it was one thing that we enjoyed so much together. And the show was just fabulous. And, I mean, one experience that must have been for you in your time of life to be part of it. It was such an amazing show. My God. I mean, we still talk about it today. I mean, I think that show will be talked about forever.
Well, you know, it's one of those just magical moments in time. First,
yeah.
When it first aired, it was an old show.
Right.
So it's always new because it's a period of time in this country, you know, kind of a, you know, maybe a fanciful time of the best of what we could be, but it's evergreen because since it's old, it's always new, and every generation they discover it, and because of the really wonderful talent behind it, I was a small part, but the cast, the chemistry was just incredible. You couldn't predict that.
You didn't have a small part. You had a huge part. Oh, come on, you had a huge part.
But Gary Marshall was just a wonderful boss and mentor to all of us. And it also broadened us out. He inspired us to learn many other parts of show business.
Nice.
He thought it was important to survive. That's why, you know, most of us are still involved, still successful in creating shows, directing shows. And it's because of Gary. He inspired us to not waste our time, don't let ego stop us, and take advantage of being on the Paramount lot and really, you know, learn other crafts.
Right. Well, he seemed like an amazing guy. I mean, I saw the retrospect that they did on him recently about, 2 months ago, and it was just fabulous. I mean, it was amazing to me, all the things and the people. I mean, he was like a dad almost. I mean, he really cared for people. It wasn't just you know, it just wasn't a show to him, you know, and it showed. You felt it. And I think maybe that's why it worked so well too, you know. It was so good, but yeah. I don't know if many people remember, but I mean, Happy Days was kind of spun off from Love American Style / American Graffiti, and I loved Love American Style, and I remember that episode with you, Ron Howard, and Marion Ross. I mean, yeah, and the three of you, you stayed on, which was great, and I got to ask you, I mean, the show was not the show without Henry Winkler, but I mean, initially, it was supposed to be based on you and Ron Howard as Richie
right.
and Potsy. Did it bother you a little bit that the show kind of went a little to the other way instead, that it blew up the way it did?
No, actually, people would ask me, are you jealous of Henry? I said, are you kidding? He bought me a house.
That's true, right?
Oh, heck. I said, go, Henry, man. I'm hanging on here. Go. Yes, go. Hey,
oh, that's so funny. Oh, my God. That's hysterical. But, I mean, it was great. I mean, and Don also mentioned that you were the one that said, why don't we put together a band? And that's
yeah.
how you guys started doing the singing. And the both
yes.
of you, the both of you sing fabulously. I can't believe that you're not more known for your vocals instead of your acting. I mean, it's just amazing to me. So, but now.
At the time, music was a big deal. I would do concerts
right.
all over the world
right.
for years. And then later on, I decided to get behind the camera. And, you know, I'm very entrepreneurial, and I went into the. Into inventing products and into directing and writing and all that kind of stuff.
Right,
so basically,
right.
you know, I became more behind, much more behind things than in front, you know.
Right. That's great. You did a lot of directing as well.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
yeah.
Over probably close to 400 hours of television.
And
yeah.
did you learn it from Gary and did also Ron Howard? I mean, did they get that or
learned,
you already,
you know,
already had that?
No, well, you know, you learn a lot just from being an actor. But then on the lot during Happy Days, Gary would make open things up. So I was able to stand by Polanski while he was directing Chinatown on the back lot and ask questions.
Wow.
I was able to watch John Schlesinger direct Day of the Locust. And
wow.
ask questions. I was able to see all the grease numbers being filmed and ask questions. So it was like a film school for me.
Right.
And so, yeah, I mean, I had the best teachers in the world.
Yeah, the whole thing was a learning experience. Wow, I didn't know that that's where you learned, too. Did Ron Howard do the same thing, hang out with those guys, too?
Ron was already going. He was pretty prolific director even then. And but the first, as a producer and writer, some of the first shows that I was involved in that were greenlit was with Ron as a partner, and he directed them, and so I was able to, you know, to learn a lot from Ron too.
Right. Wow. I mean, you guys are all still tight to this day, I believe, right? I mean, from what I've gathered.
Especially Don's my best friend now.
Well, we're Facebook friends, and I see a lot of your posts, and some of the things you say are, I don't know where you come up with them. You definitely got to put a book together. I mean, your sayings are so on the money and just
Thank
prolific.
You.
They really are. I think I mentioned to you once, call it Ansonisms or something. I don't know what I said. I think it would make a great book. I mean, why not, you know? So out of all the things you've directed, which one did you enjoy the most? I don't want to ask. That's too, you know, that's too much of a...
Well, I like the one. I mean, I've been very fortunate. And just directing many, many different genres.
Right.
You know,
that's what I was
going to
ask you. What's your favorite genre? Because you've done a bunch.
I like them all. You know, I just like good stories.
Yeah.
And sci-fi is so much fun because, you know, you're creating things that aren't there, using CGI, all these special effects.
Mm.
And I mean, it's a much more imaginative kind of genre, you know, which is it's fun. It's fun just to invent things. And then on the other side, if you have a really good human drama that really affects people's hearts, that actually maybe enlightens people, and it kind of echoes into society to make things better. I mean, that's probably the most satisfying to me.
Wow.
Films that really that have evergreen effect for the betterment of society.
Right.
You know, that really sticks with me.
Well, it's funny, you know, when the show was on, the rumor was that you were related to Henry Heimlich, and you really are. I remember when it was on, they were like, did you know he's related to Henry Heimlich? And so,
I know. I hope we can talk about this. It's probably the most important thing I've been part of in my entire life. And Dr. Heimlich is my second cousin, but ever since I was born, I called him Uncle Hank.
Right.
So he's always been uncle. And he passed away going on 3 years ago.
Wow.
But at 96 years old, by the way.
Oh, my.
And I keep thinking, dude, what do you want to be? Do you want to be a movie star or this or that? But how would you like, because you're living, people are living every day. That's a pretty good reason, you know, for living and making this world a better place. Every day. Because Hank lived, people are alive. Every day.
Right,
every day someone's life saved because of him. Every single day.
How did he come up with it? Was somebody choking and that was his just first instinct and it stuck? Or he said, this is how we do this? Or incident?
He personally saw people get in trouble with this back slapping. And it just inspired him. He was inspired him to start researching and finding a better way.
Right.
And he did. And, you know, and it was so funny because just the circumstance, he and I got on national television for the first time on Merv Griffin Show. And just by circumstance, and he tried it out on Merv, and that's when the Heimlich maneuver blew up around the country.
Not that much longer,
he was on Carson. And it became part of the social fabric. But he's always been a huge, huge influence for me.
And then,
through the years, I went into the product business. I love creating problem-solving products.
I love that
are really, really good. So years ago, many, many years ago, before I was even in the product business, I had an exhausting day directing. And I'm driving home, and I fell asleep at the wheel.
Mm.
And I couldn't kill myself, other people. Thank God I didn't. But it scared me.
Yeah.
And when I talked to Hank about it, Dr. Heimlich, who's he's just brilliant. He's brilliant at old science. He knows the sensory connection of the body. And he said, listen, when you're going to have exhausting days, have cut-up lemons with you.
Mm.
And he explained how when you bite into a cut-up lemon, the citric acid and the sour lemon hits the lingual nerve on top of your tongue.
Mm.
And the automatic reflex reaction of the body is adrenaline. You're up. You're alert. Instantly awake. Nothing in your system. The body waking the body to sensory connection and reflex reaction. And it's adrenaline.
Right.
And no different than when you go into the doctor's office and they're checking your reflexes with the little rubber mallet, you know, your elbows, your knees. Well, this is sensory connection to tongue and brain, and the reflex reaction is adrenaline. Boop, you get adrenaline, you're up, you're alert, nothing in your system. So I did that for years, cut up lemons. Never had the problem again. In fact, but I used it forever. I used it for if I was tired during the day, whatever. It would wake me up. It'd make me alert instantly. Nothing in my system. My body waking my body. So years later, I'm in the product business, and I start researching drowsy driving, which is catastrophic in this country.
Yeah.
More deaths than drunk and medicated combined. Horrific problem that could be prevented.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, then I said, why can't we make a spray drop of citric acid, sour lemon water, and have a spray drop and hit it right on the top of your tongue.
Right.
And I talked to Dr. Heimlich about it, and he said, you will save more lives than the Heimlich maneuver. You do this, it's brilliant, do it.
Right.
And he helped me create alert drops. And if people go to alertdrops.com, might be the most important click in their life.
Right.
They go to alertdrops.com, you can read all the science behind this little spray, all the clinicals and the testimonials, but more importantly, the science behind it, why it works, how it works. And then we discovered, aside from drowsy driving, that even right now with the coronavirus, we're helping so many people with what's called isolation fatigue.
Mm-hmm.
Their lives have changed so much, they're just exhausted doing nothing. And Alert Drops is really helping them become alert, clear, feeling better, students studying, they're up all night studying, they use alert drops instead of all this crazy energy crap that hurts you and too much caffeine. So anytime you need to be alert, you know, less fatigue, God bless Dr. Heim, like a couple of sprays of alert drop on your tongue, and you're ready to go. So people go to alertdrops.com. Not only do you make your life better, you can save the life of your children. Your husband will come home. Your kids will come home. Right. It is something everybody should have in their pocket and set them
for. Absolutely. Well, I was going to ask you how you came up with it, and you just answered that all for me. Thank you. Because I was going to ask you what made you want to do that, and how did you get involved in that? So,
right.
And you know what? Not only are you saving yourself and lives for your family, but God knows who you're going to kill in the process if you fall asleep. So,
well, that's
you know,
the problem. Right. If you go to images.google.com and you go, if people died from drowsy driving, or the ones that died, they're usually not the driver. They're the ones getting hit.
Right, right.
You see all these kids. But not only that, like alert drops, they did a huge cover story on exhaustion in the film industry because of the hours. And the author, the journalist, Anita Bush, recommended alert drops. And we're on sets all over the world.
Wow.
Because of the long hours. I mean, it's very important to stay safe on a set.
Right.
You're putting
right.
up lights. You're up on gurneys. You got to be alert. And alert drops, it's all over the entertainment business. We donated thousands to the front, to the heroic healthcare workers on the front lines.
Right.
They're exhausted working 6 hour days. They're using alert drops. Police departments, fire. Well, I didn't even tell you. Alert drops has been honored by the United States Congress.
Well,
by the California State Senate, by the city of L.A.
You helped them out during the impeachment because they had to stay up so many hours. No, I remember reading that.
Well, isn't that funny? I gave them the opportunity.
No, I remember reading that when the impeachment was going on, that you had to help them out because, you know, to keep them awake. So,
right.
So what other...
And you're exhausted. And, you know, and what's great about it, because Dr. Heim looks genius. Or not just knowing how this works. It's very old science. All we did was make a better scooter.
Right.
And we didn't invent anything. We just made a better scooter. This is very old science.
And you packaged
it. He just knew how to help people safely. People are drinking too much caffeine. They're doing these phony energy drinks, and they just screw up your system and your health. And even if you take two cups of coffee, it takes 20 minutes to take effect. And then you're all jittery, and then you need more. It does not stop the problem. Alert drops stops the problem.
And lemon, you know, you get that instantaneous reaction. So,
I tell people too, if you don't want to buy alert drops, that's fine. Have cut up lemon.
Right.
You know, that'll work. It'll be a little messier, but it'll sure work. And I just want people to be safe. I love, and I'm paying Dr. Heimlich for it. I love simple ways of saving unneeded tragedies, stopping unneeded tragedies.
Right.
I just feel that so, and I can't in good conscience spend the rest of my life not promoting that.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, it's a great product, and it's needed for sure. I mean, what other products? Do you have any other products that you have out there, or is Alert Drop
We've had a lot of products. We were on QVC for 10 years.
Oh, wow.
But I'll tell you, the commerce business is really interesting. It's really very competitive. And then I decided with Alert Drops, this is its own category. There's nothing like it. It stands alone. It's just, it's Mickey Mouse for the product business. I mean, there's only one.
Right.
And I decided to spend my time on that.
Right.
Because I know this is important. It's not a vanity product, you know, and it's not even making your life a little more convenient. It saves your life. It saves your life.
Right.
And I thought, you know, and with Dr. Heimlich's passion behind it, I said, I gotta stick to this. I gotta push this. I gotta spend my time on this.
Mm.
And right now, if people go right now, to alertshops.com. There's a thing that they unlock. If you buy anything on there, we'll double it for free.
Wow.
If you buy 100 units, you'll get 200 units. If you buy one, you'll get two. If you buy 12, you get 24.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's really, really good. Yeah, it's really, really, it's a really, really good situation for people, especially companies. They need a lot of them.
Right. Now, I wanted to ask you about, well, your last name is actually Heimlich. You're going by your first and middle name all these years. You're actually Anton William Heimlich.
Tell me about it.
So you're a Dr. Heimlich, too.
except when I was doing show business, no one knew Dr. Heimlich, and an agent said, Anson Heimlich? Why don't you use your middle name and add an S?
That's so funny.
You know?
When you first started, you started as Anson Heimlich?
Yeah. I go, no.
Use your middle name,
add an S.
Well, it works. Funny? It works.
I don't know. Now, I mean, Heimlich would have been, it's so funny. My dad, it's H-E-I-M-L-I-C-H. My dad changed it to K because, you know, grew up a Jewish family, right? And he was two Purple Hearts in World War II, my father, a real war hero. And he says Heimlich, he changed it to K because he was so you know, he just got out of the World War, you know?
Right, right.
So he changed it to K, and everyone else is H. You know?
That's hysterical. I have to apologize to you. I'm getting messages stating that people can't reach us. We just had a storm over here, so I think our line is down. I apologize, Anson. I'm sure everybody wants to talk to you. And unfortunately, they can't get through. My co-host.
Well, that's a really nice. That's a very nice excuse. Actually, no one wants to talk to me.
No.
You make it sound dramatic.
No, I just got like 10 texts saying I can't get through. I'm trying to call, and even my co-host, he can't even get on. That's why I'm by myself. He couldn't call tonight because he can't get through. It's crazy.
Well, thanks a lot.
Well, you'll have to come.
You've got to keep up with technology.
Yeah, well, you'll have to definitely come back to us so people can talk to you, because I apologize about the storm. There was nothing I could do. Now, back to Happy Days. Which one was your most memorable show that you liked the most? I mean, there must be a handful, not even a handful, probably trunks full that were your most memorable, but which one really, really hit home?
The one that resonated with people to this day is the one where Joni, I didn't realize Joni fell in love with me.
And I sang
Put Your Head on My Shoulder to her.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, that one. I think that's the highest rated Happy Days episode in history.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the one that really sticks with people.
Yeah.
And
Well, you guys are also known for the infamous jumping the shark. Everybody uses that phrase now. So.
Yeah, but that's kind of baloney.
It is. It was a good episode.
Now, the show was on 10 and a half years.
Right?
That was season 5. And it went on for 5.5 more years.
Right.
I don't think we quite jumped the shark, but. The story is one of Howard Stern's people created Jump the Shark website, right? And he didn't like that episode of Happy Days, so he thought, that's the beginning of the end. So we became associated with Jump the Shark, even though we lasted. We weren't even half through our run yet. However, that guy, years later, sold Jump the Shark to TV Guide for $10 million.
Right. That's what I was going to say. But at the time, it didn't feel like you guys were, quote, unquote, jumping the shark. It was an episode.
No, we didn't. We were just, you know? We were still climbing.
I know. The show was great. It lasted forever. It was fantastic. And it'll always be etched in my mind. I mean, my favorites, well, there was many favorites, but I loved when Pinky Tuscadero came on and Leather Tuscadero, and I always loved when you guys did the music. You know, I like music, so, you know, when you guys did the music, those were always my favorites. Like the Brady Bunch, when they did their singing shows, those are the ones I like too. Now, how did you, when you were doing the show and you guys were doing the singing, were you already a singer and had been in a studio to make music, or was that all new to you? I mean, you love singing.
I had been a I actually, you know, my experience is musicals. You know, I've done a lot of musicals.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
As a stage performer. And then I did a lot of nightclubs and things like that.
And I
actually did a short-lived variety show with Tony Randall, I think three episodes, called Top of the Month, where I was singing. So I had a singing background. I convinced Gary Marks to put it on the show.
Right.
Because you didn't make money back then.
Right.
And I thought I thought it'd be good for the show, get a band on there. And if I sang on the show, I thought I could get a record deal, and I could get booked for concerts and make some money.
Always thinking.
Don't see what you don't have. Always see what you have.
Exactly.
You know, there's always opportunity. People spend too much time denying opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
They always see what they don't have, not what they have. And what they have, they can do something with. And they don't even open the curtain for that, you know?
Right. Now, when you directed some Star Treks, and now do you enjoy that genre personally? Not for directing, but are you into sci-fi?
Oh, yeah. I love sci-fi with some depth, you know, with some character,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah,
Where there's a story to it, but there's still, like, this heart and there's a message, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Now, and that was Star Trek. Star Trek always had a message.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Now, you have a book out as well called Singing to Bulldog, From Happy Days to Hollywood Director and the Unlikely Mentor Who Got Me There. I'm guessing you're talking about Gary Marshall or no?
No. That was when I was in high school. I grew up with no money, very lower middle class, always had to work. I was an assistant janitor in high school at a department store, and I was really unconfident, lost. Mm. And my boss was a man by the name of Willie Turner, the head janitor.
Oh.
And he was a black man.
Yeah.
In his 50s, a functioning alcoholic, and my savior. He would call the janitorial room the talk room. And he's one of the first people to talk to me, not at me. In the time I worked as a janitor, he helped me find me. He got me the confidence to move forward. If it wasn't for Willie, we would not be talking today.
Wow.
So the book is really paying forward those conversations in the talk room. Now, I have all these Forrest Gump stories, getting kidnapped by the President of the United States' daughter, you know, meeting Elvis Presley in a parking lot in Monroe, Louisiana. I mean, crazy stories. But every story relates back to the talk room and Willie. I wanted the reader to have the same opportunity I had for Willie's wisdom.
Wow.
And so basically it's paying Willie forward. And
Yeah. It sounds like it's really a touching book. Oh, man. And now, Star Maker Products, how did you get into makeup? Or is that something that's health-orientated as well?
Well, that was when I started, you know, got into the product business. It started many, 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 many years ago.
Gotcha.
And then it ended up on QVC for 10 years.
Mm.
And then kind of reorganized a little bit. And now we're doing alert drops.
Wow.
Again, people, go to alertdrops.com.
Yes.
And protect your family, protect your friends, seriously.
Yeah. And not only is it good for you and will keep you alive, it probably tastes delicious. I love lemons, so.
It's very tart. I'll tell you that. It's very tart.
But I love a lemon, you know?
Yeah, but you need that. You need the citric acid with the sour lemon triggers the lingual nerve.
Right.
You need them both. And that it triggers it, creates a sensory connection. And you'll get, you know, a reflex reaction of adrenaline.
Right. During this craziness, you know, everything's shut down. What have you been up to?
Boy, it's been probably like everybody else. Home projects, you know, thank goodness we're in a, you know, creating things as it starts in your head. So it's always a pretty lonely experience anyway, whether you're creating a product, a script, whatever. So that hasn't changed. You know, that hasn't changed as far as, you know, the process for that.
Right.
But what is hard is not having the outside energy, not being able to touch or see people or, you know, all that kind of
stuff.
Yeah,
right.
But I try to be, you know, have a schedule, be productive. I try to keep moving forward. It's very easy to just run in place.
Right, of course, yeah.
What have you been doing?
I've been working from home, so nothing really has changed for me other than the fact that I just roll out of bed and go and turn the computer on at the studio and work, and then when I'm done with that, then I focus on the show, and when I'm done with that, I throw my kids somewhere in the middle in there, my family. So nothing really has changed for me. Other than the fact, I mean, I'm always constantly busy anyway, so, and I got to be honest, I wish we would go back to it the way it was here on the East Coast. It's I don't enjoy the people anymore. I was loving the fact, I was enjoying the quiet, I was enjoying the no traffic, and not having to go out unless I really needed to, and I don't know, I'm perfectly fine in the comfort of my home. So, and I'm creative as well, so I'm working on that stuff too. So, but
we're lucky that we have that.
Right,
that
I know there are there are people who can't handle what's going on. I know.
No, man, most people they're in jobs with people. It's just a different environment.
Right.
And that's where isolation fatigue comes in.
Right.
Because it's a sudden change of environment. And It's psychological. It's kind of depressing.
Yeah, see, it doesn't bother me, but I understand. It doesn't bother me, but I totally understand how it can affect.
Yeah, it won't bother you, and it won't bother me as much. But it'll bother probably 98% of people that are in people jobs. You're involved with people all day.
Right. Well, especially
and
people.
And all of a sudden, you don't have that energy. It's it's a huge change.
Right, and especially people who live alone, you know, they've got, you know, they're really isolated now, you know. And
Yeah.
Well, we have to make sure they get some alert drops.
Hell yeah, alertdrops.com.
Absolutely.
More than that, everybody, in our California here, we've been so, you see, we're like one of the worst in the country now.
I know.
Because you know, wearing face masks, this is not political. This is not, well, I can wear it if I want to. I don't have to.
I know.
It's nothing to do with that. It has to do with, you're going to, it's almost to me, it's almost like, don't wear a mask. You're shooting a vulnerable person with a gun.
Right.
Because, you know, I mean, come on.
And
this
common
sense. This is not, it's not political. It's nothing about it. How about just being, you know, a good person.
Right. Be a good American. I just wish this had taken place maybe 10 years ago. It might have been a different scenario. You know, people like maybe during Happy Days time. I mean, you know, it would be American to wear a mask, you know. And I said, some businessman we got there, the idiot, had he said, wear a mask, he could have made a fortune with Trump masks. But, you know, some people are entrepreneurs, some aren't. But, you know, anyway, but, wear a mask, damn it. But,
and also follow the protocols. I mean, here July 4th in California, it's just people, I mean, I just didn't get it.
Right. Well, we don't.
And now we're paying for it.
Right. Yeah. Well, the longer the people don't adhere to what needs to be done, the longer we'll never get back to normal. So that's
now, are you based in New Jersey or New York?
I'm in New Jersey, yes. Yes.
Okay.
And we were shut down for the 3 months, and, you know, we're looking good now. So is New York. I mean, we did the right thing.
Yeah, well, Governor Cuomo is, like, phenomenal.
Is he the man or what? Oh, my God.
Phenomenal. Phenomenal leader.
I know.
That's a leader. That is a leader.
Yeah.
He's not out for himself. He's not spinning anything.
No.
He is a leader, man.
I know.
And look at this. And look, through all that, I mean, he did a phenomenal job. Still is.
Yeah. I think he actually got called to go to some other states to help out with how to do it. I
Georgia.
Heard. You know? Oh, it was Georgia. Okay, I knew I heard. I thought I heard something, yeah. But Well, Jansen, yeah. Is there anything else you want folks to know out there about what's going on, or how they can, other than going to alertdrops.com? Anything else that we could tell folks to get from you?
Just tell folks to, you know, stay safe. You know, think of others. I think if we think of others,
Right.
Just do the right thing. Whatever party you're in, whatever you believe, whatever religion, whatever, that's fine. But just be protective of each other.
Right.
That's all. Be protective of each other. Stay safe and calm down.
Yeah.
And just do the right thing.
Right. And let's be kind to one another, you know?
Yes. Yes.
So. Well, Anson, thank you so much for joining us, and I apologize for the delay on getting you on the line, and also for our phone connection, and it was a pleasure. Oh, my God, my mother would be sitting here smacking me. Let me talk, I guarantee it. But I thank you so much. Good luck with the alert drop, and let everybody to know. Let's go to alertdrops.com and help yourself out and everybody else around you, for especially driving fatigue, and specifically right now with the isolation and just everything going on. It's definitely the more healthier option than one of the any energy drinks, like he said. I mean, those affect your heart and other parts of your organs. Alert Drops is healthy. It's a lemon, you know.
It's a lemon.
I mean,
it's a high-powered lemon.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, sir. It was a pleasure and an honor, and I thank you again from the bottom of my heart for joining us, and I hope to keep in touch.
Absolutely. Call. Yeah, anytime. Love to do this again. God bless you. Thank you so much. God bless
you,
everybody.
You too. Thank you, Anson. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Oh, boy. What a show tonight. I enjoyed myself. Lately, all the shows have been wonderful with our guests. I don't know if you're an avid listener. Most of you do listen all the time. Doing the show is really a thrill for me because I have guests on that I grew up watching and listening to and music just like you. And when I get them on the show, it's almost like my bucket list. I may not be meeting them in person, but I'm meeting them on the air just like you. And it's just amazing to me that we remain friends. And, I mean, he just said we could keep in touch and I could call him anytime. And you know what? He meant that. He meant that. And they all do, all of our guests. So thank you again to Stanley Goldman, author of, hold on, man, I don't remember this. Left to the Mercy of a Rude Stream, The Bargain That Broke Adolf Hitler and Saved My Mother, available on Amazon.com. It's a phenomenal book. I mean, if you're into the history of that era and about Germany and Hitler and just the true story of survival, it sounds amazing, the excerpts I read, and I'm looking forward to probably doing the audio version. But again, it's on Amazon.com. If you can't find it under the name, look under Stan Goldman, and you'll find it there. And also, the fabulous Anson Williams. I mean, my God, again, if my mother was here, she'd be knocking me off this chair to talk to him and pushing me off. I could only imagine all the questions she would be asking him. Oh, how's Fonzie? How's this one? How's that one? My sisters know what I'm talking about, but thank you all. And well, we actually have an announcement. We had a guest change for Sunday's show. Jared Hewitt had to reschedule. He'll probably be back in August, we're hoping. So since Jared won't be joining us, we're going to have Kevin Spiritus on. He just won an Emmy the other night. And I can't wait to get him on the show for outstanding writing team in a digital series. He's also an actor, and he's been a lot of things you've probably seen. When you see his picture, once I do the promos, you'll know who he is. And then on the 29th, Stephen Taibbi, he's an actor and a lawyer. He's an actor and author, and he has this great book out about he is the recipient of, I believe, I believe a heart, if not a heart. But anyway, he is in touch with the people who donated their organs to him. And this, he wrote a book about it. And I can't wait to talk to him about this. It's really amazing. And Julia Benjamin, she's an actress, and we're going to talk to her. August is shaping up pretty well. I'm actually behind this month on my scheduling, but I will catch up very soon. Thank you again to our guests, Stanley Goldman and Anson Williams, and the Hive Bar and Bistro, Garfield, New Jersey. They are doing pickup and delivery and limited seating in regard to distancing. And Precious, and they're in Garfield, New Jersey. Precious Memory Video in Kittnersville, Pennsylvania. KWB Wines in South Africa. Tees for the Times and Other Stuff in Clifton, New Jersey. Syntech Productions in Lenoka Harbor, New Jersey. Oleander Public Relations in Texas. Take a Break from Cancer.org for Pete's Sake. And Joey Mac's Hot Dog Truck / Cafe in Harrison, New Jersey. And those hot dogs are delicious. And I don't know about you, but I like my dogs smothered in everything. They're kibasi too. And their slogan is fabulous. Oh, God. The best thing you'll ever put in your mouth. Oh, where is it? Oral satisfaction guaranteed. That's it. I knew it. I knew it would come to me. Yep, but, well, that's the best thing you could put in your mouth, oral satisfaction guarantee. So thank you all again, and we hope to hear from you guys soon. Have a good night, everybody. Stay safe, and it's been a pleasure. Take care. Bye-bye.